So this talk is going to be going through some of the main myths, the main Zionist myths that are used to back up the state of Israel. And specifically, it's kind of going to be looking at the manufacturing of Jewish identity that helped lay a basis for the kind of Israeli national identity that we see today, you know, which was really the project of turning what was a dispersed religious group that encompassed, you know, multiple different ethnicities, you know, multiple different religious practices and cultural practices into the kind of united, you know, homogenous group we see today, kind of generally just referred to as the Jewish people. You know, a group which we are told is united by ethnicity and shares not just, you know, the kind of an ethnic history, but also a collective memory. And to kind of to promote the homogenous collective that exists now in modern times, it was really necessary to create a narrative that connected, you know, throughout time and space, the current members of the community with their kind of so-called forebearers or forefathers. Quite clearly, though, this is true of all nation states, and most socialists, most left-wing people kind of have a good bit of hostility and cynicism around the kind of myths they use to lay the basis of nation states. You know, you think about in the 17th century, you know, in Europe, most people believed they were descended directly from the Trojans. You know, no one quite believes that now anymore. Since the end of the 19th century, textbooks have been trying to, you know, create a linear narrative that connects today's Italians and it turns Roman people of the ancient world into today's typical Italians. And in schools of the French Third Republic, Gaelic tribes who rebelled during the time of Julius Caesar were referred to as your typical Frenchmen. And in the 20th century, after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the inhabitants of New Turkey decided they were in fact white Aryans, descended of the Sumerians and the Hittites. Like, you know, just these kind of fantastical myths. But the kind of list of the way these different myths are, you know, the different myths that exist just goes on and on and on. And I think the point is to say that Israel is not individual in having created a myth that places a particular national group that emerged in modern times in the context of some kind of long-standing tradition dating back to ancient times. And while socialists are committed to breaking down all the kind of different forms of nationalism that exists, I think it's particularly important for us to examine the myths that are, you know, used to establish and justify the establishment of the State of Israel. I think it's because the justifications for the State of Israel, like, they're not just academic questions, which is the way it's often posed in a lot of literature around the subject. But the State of Israel today is the world's last remaining apartheid state, a state whose existence necessitates the ongoing dispossession and genocide of the Palestinian people. And, you know, I think it's important to kind of have a bit of a conception of what the Zionist narrative actually is, because I think a lot of it has been turned into common sense. So, you know, oh, Jewish people, they're expelled, this is awful, this is the story. But I think it's important to have a bit of an understanding of what exactly some of this is based on. So for the Israelis, the traditional Zionist history of the Jewish people begins with the words of Moses, you know, Moses in the Old Testament, which is, you know, not really where we think of nationalist myths starting, that when God handed down the Ten Commandments, he also granted the land of Israel to the Jewish people, and it was meant to be theirs, or mine actually, for all time. And the argument then goes on that the Jewish people were, you know, expelled from Egypt, which is, like, that's not something I'm particularly going to go into, because it's not the main basis of the Zionist myth, but if people are more interested in learning about the total fallacy of that bit of Jewish history, there's a great book called The Bible on Earth that you could definitely read. And then after being expelled, after the Egyptian exodus, the Jewish people then conquered and settled the land of Israel that, you know, God had promised us. You know, the nations of David and Solomon were set up, which then split into the nations of Judah and Israel. And then the more modern narrative, or more modern as in ancient times, but more relevant to the modern nation state of Israel. So the nation was then forced into exile twice, unfortunately. First after the fall of the first temple, and then after the fall of the second temple, which was in 70 CE. And they argue that this nation is the most, you know, ancient nation on earth, forced to wander the desert for 2,000 years. You know, and thrown through their bitter wanderings to all edges of the earth, to, you know, Yemen, to Russia, to Morocco, to Poland, and that this is how it is that world Jewry, you know, existed all throughout Europe when we see throughout the Middle Ages and also the rise of capitalism later. And the argument then is that, well, actually Jews all around the world today are blood related and descended from the original nation that existed, you know, in the ancient times under, you know, in the nations of Israel and Judah. So for the Zionist historians, the setting up of the state of Israel is not, you know, the story of dispossession and genocide of the Palestinian people, but rather it's the story of the Jewish people coming home, you know, coming back to the land that always belonged exclusively to them and not to the Palestinians, who are kind of represented in some of this as this kind of handful of, you know, ragtag people who managed to descend, wander into a land, you know, which they had no legitimate claim to and no history connecting them to. And this kind of supposedly religious narrative actually required a complete break with actual Jewish tradition as it existed before modern Zionism. You know, the exile of Jewish people was historically understood by rabbis, you know, predating Zionism, as punishment for the spiritual transgressions of the ancient Jewish people. Returning to the, you know, the promised land, quote unquote, was not a geographical concept, it was a metaphysical concept. And any idea that Jews could return to the promised land prior to the return of the Messiah was kind of the very height of sacrilege. The idea was that we were thrown out because of, you know, the ancient Jews' sins. And actually it was only when the world would be perfect, you know, only when all sins would be forgiven, that you would be able to return to this land. It's, you know, very much about the cycle of remorse and repentance. And, you know, there's a whole series of different Jewish theologians who wrote quite a lot about it. Yaakov Rabkin, who, you know, is one of the prominent theologians, he's also a Jewish history professor, argues that Zionism, in fact, created a brand new religion that was entirely distinct from Judaism. But, you know, a whole series of the other theologians writing just immediately post-Holocaust didn't, you know, exactly say that Zionism was a new Jewish religion, but that actually Zionism was an anti-religion, that it was the secularisation of Jewish myths, dismissing key parts of the Jewish text, and actually had nothing to do with what, you know, these kind of Jewish texts had ever been about or had ever argued. And I think the old religious myths clearly had to be changed because it was about creating a new nationalist myth. And even though the, you know, Jewish religious prayer, you know, the liturgy refers to returning to the land of Israel, this was never a literal desire that any section of world Jewry until, you know, modern times, until the rise of Zionism in the 1930s, you know, the political ideas that Jews should have an exclusive state, until the rise of that ideology was, you know, never an idea that the majority of world Jewry held in their head. You know, it was a minority opinion among European Jewry, and not really something that was ever talked about, ever discussed. There is no history of it ever existing under, you know, with any other sections of Jewish people throughout the world. And like looking at the migration patterns of Jews in the, you know, the Eurasian landmass until this time really illustrates it, that, you know, Jews were always trying to move westward, you know, not to the east, not to Palestine, but to, you know, through to Eastern Europe, to Western Europe, or to the United States. This was the, you know, the path of Jewish immigration. And, you know, one of the key books I'm kind of going to be talking about today is Shlomo Sands, who wrote this book called The Invention of the Jewish People. Because in this work, Sands talks about Zionism inventing this myth history, as he calls it, that's used to justify the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and describes how, on one hand, the Zionists claim kind of a divine connection to the land of Israel, but also very much inextricably link the kind of ownership of the land with their ability to have political rights or political freedom. And Sands' book explores all the kind of the archaeological evidence and the basis that illustrates the total fallacy of any idea that the mass of Jewish communities today have any connection with the people who lived in, you know, the historic lands of Israel and Judah. So Sands, the way he talks about the Bible is he says that we should see the Bible not as a book, but as a grand library that was written, revised and adapted in the course of three centuries. From the late 6th to the early 2nd BCE, it should be read as a multi-layered literary construction of a religious and philosophical nature, or as theological parables. The ancient authors sought to create a coherent religious community. They invented the category of Israel as sacred chosen people. And like, there's a whole series of things you can say about the way the Bible was written and rewritten. Again, the book, The Bible on Earth, really goes through a lot of it. One of my particular favourite stories is the story of David and Goliath, where most people know David, you know, tiny little David defeated giant Goliath. And what that book actually goes through is that this was the original and one of the most successful pieces of wartime propaganda, that the tiny nation of Israel was fighting a myriad of enemies. And actually the kind of the story of the tiny nation, the tiny person succeeding and overcoming is kind of, you know, I think some propaganda that the Bush and Obama governments wish they could find as effective today. But the kind of challenge that this conception of the Bible, this conception of the biblical narrative and the text poses to the Zionist manipulation of the kind of fictitious biblical, you know, Israel, cynically serving nationalist claims on Arab land is pretty obvious. And, you know, one of the things that, that Shlomo Sands advances is basically, you know, is what he says is, it was not exile, it was conversion. So that he brings the entire idea of conversion as opposed to exile being the story of the Jewish people. And the supreme paradigm of exile was needed in order to construct a long-range memory in which an imagined, you know, exiled nation race was posited as the direct continuation of the people of the Bible that preceded it, is what Sands says. Under the influence of the of other historians who have dealt with the same issue in recent years, he argues that the exile of the Jewish people was originally actually a Christian myth that depicted the event as divine punishment for not believing in Christ, for having rejected the Christian Gospels. And he argues that actually most Jewish people were not exiled by the Romans, but were permitted to remain in the country. And, you know, he puts the numbers who might have been exiled at the tens of thousands of most, and further argues that most of the Jews actually probably converted to Islam, following the Arab conquest and were assimilated amongst the conquerors, which was quite common if you think about it. In that time period, you know, nations that were taken over by Christianity, the majority of the peasantry, the majority of people would then assimilate into that culture, into that particular religious practice. And he writes, I started looking in research studies about the exile from the land, an important event in Jewish history, almost like the Holocaust. But to my astonishment, I discovered that there was no literature. The reason is that no one exiled the people of the country. The Romans did not exile people, and they could not have done so even if they'd wanted to. They didn't have the trains, the trucks, you know, any of the logistics to support entire populations. This kind of logistics did not exist till after the 20th century. From this, in effect, the whole book was born, the realisation that Judaic society was not dispersed and not exiled. So it was, you know, what he talked about when he talked about the justification for his books. So the whole idea of Jews as converts really puts paid to the Zionist narrative of exile. You know, in Sands' analysis, early Judaism really pioneered the art of conversion, you know, something that we see later in the narrative that Christianity was able to pick up on and use themselves to, you know, to quite great effect. You know, and a really critical moment in the spread of the Jewish religion was the translation of the Bible into Greek. And Israeli historians, I was reading quite a lot of this stuff, and there are all these Israeli historians who really rail against this and reject that this was any kind of trigger for conversion or any kind of illustration that conversion was going on, and argue instead that actually it was that Jewish people didn't know Hebrew, and so the translations were intended for them, which to me really begs far more questions than it answers, not least why it is that so many Jewish people didn't know their national language and thus needed the Bible translated for them. Well, what actually seems like a far more logical answer is that the Bibles that were translated into Greek were intended for the Greek and, you know, the Hellenistic converts at that point in time. One of the, you know, there's a whole, you know, whole series of different examples of the conversion who took place, and I really encourage people to read the book because unless you wanted me to read the whole thing to you, I can't really go through it all. But another mass conversion took place at the Black Sea as well, at the Kingdom of Khazar, towards the end of the 8th century. And the Khazar elite acquired Judaism as a form of diplomatic immunity and kind of neutrality to stay neutral in the, you know, the surrounding clashes of the states where the kind of main clashes were between Islam and between Christianity. You know, and the writings at the time, you know, and there's, again, there's thousands of them, really back up the kind of suggestion that, that Shlomo Sands makes. So, you know, 10th century author, Ibel Fanik, who said, all Khazars are Jews, but they've been Judaicized really recently. Mohammed Ibn al-Shaha, who was also a writer in the 10th century, says the Khazars write in Hebrew letters. And actually, the national language of the Khazar nation was Hebrew. It was one of the things that really led to the flourishing of Hebrew and the continuation of, you know, of Hebrew writing that still continues to this day. But the thing that I think is also interesting about this is that Shlomo Sands, you can get a feeling of it when you're reading his book that it's just this, you know, amazing, massive revelation. That, you know, he came up with this entirely new fantastic idea. But the whole idea of the Khazar nation having converted is no revelation at all. That, you know, in 1976, a book by Arthur Koestler is called The 13th Tribe, which was, you know, kind of reviled and ignored by the majority of Zionist and Israeli academics, you know, puts forward the argument that Jewish Khazars, the Khazar nation converted to Judaism. And which was actually something that was recognised originally by Zionist historians, and was only dropped from the story. And in the 1960s, after the 1967 Six Day War, to be precise. So Arthur wrote his book in 76, so he wrote a bit late in the ball game to get recognised, but he based it on a whole series of different literature, academic studies and archaeological studies that predated the Six-Day War that had just been generally quite accepted. And one of the things that makes this quite challenging for the Zionist myth today is actually, well, this puts forward the argument that it is the Palestinians, not the Israelis, who have some kind of historic claim to the land of Israel. That while clearly no population remains pure over thousands of years, the chances that Palestinians are descendants of the ancient Judaic people are, you know, far, far greater than the chances that, you know, European Jews like myself are. And the, you know, the first Zionists up until the Arab Revolt, you know, knew that there had been no exiling the Jews and that Palestinians were descended from the inhabitants of the land. And they knew that farmers don't leave, you know, until they're, you know, they're definitely expelled. So they did assume that the Palestinian inhabitants of the land were the original Jewish ones. So Yitzhak Ben Zvi, who people might know as the second president of the State of Israel, who's one of, you know, is probably most famous for saying in response to Palestinians fighting back against occupation, they should be crushed like grasshoppers, their heads smashed against boulders, actually wrote in 1926 that the vast majority of the peasant farmers do not have their origins in the Arab conquerors, but rather before them, in the Jewish farmers who were numerous and a majority in the building of the land. You know, and the kind of, like, this was just a generally accepted part of Zionist history at a certain point in time, and that studies contradicting the biblical account since then, though, have been banished to the realms of silence by Zionist academia in the interests of the Israeli state. And, you know, Zionist kind of demands, you know, what Sands has called this myth history to be applied to the story of the region to make it fit with the nationalist narrative. You know, David Ben-Gurion, you know, the first Prime Minister of Israel, argued during the early years of Zionism that Palestinians were descended from the original Jewish Judeans, said the Jewish farmer, like any other farmer, was not easily torn from his soil. Despite the repression and suffering, the rural population remained unchanged, and the Thelian, the Palestinian peasants, are not descendants of the Arab conquerors. Sands notes how from the moment of the, you know, Palestinian revolt against Zionist colonization and occupation, that this thesis, you know, entirely disappears. And the descendants of the Judean peasantry are banished from the Jewish national consciousness in any way, shape or form. And, you know, you think about the kind of quote that you just heard from David Ben-Gurion. Well, in 1948, the secular David Ben-Gurion was the person who formulated the preamble to the Declaration of the State of Israel, the, you know, Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel. And the preamble reads, "After being forcibly exiled from their land, the people remained faithful to it throughout their dispersion and never ceased to pray and hope for their return to it and the restoration of their political freedom." And I think it's really important to see that these are the ways that the Zionists have successfully managed to continue to propagate but also to secularise the myth of exile, which is quite important, that kind of by the, you know, simultaneously burying the myth, you know, under scholarship, kind of denying its veracity, at the same time, but also really drawing a connection between the return to land and political freedoms, drawing the connection between the religious myth, but rephrasing it in the language of secularism, in the language of political liberty, political freedoms, you know, being connected to the lack of political freedoms that Jewish people suffered as a result of, you know, this biblical myth. You know, and once the Zionists had recognised that Indigenous Palestinians would resist colonisation, they needed to bring in a population of settlers. And to do this, they imposed a common origin and identity on the diverse reality, you know, and had to invent this whole conception of the Jewish people and propagate the myth of their exile. And I think that, you know, it's quite important to see why this is important, and why, you know, this collective ethnic origin is necessary. Because, you know, Sands points out, and I really agree with this point, that membership of a religious community does not provide ownership rights to a territory, whereas an ethnic people always have a land they can claim as ancestral heritage. So, you know, it's that they had to create the myth both to undercut the Palestinian right to land, but also to justify the right of the massive Jewish people around the world to land. But I think it's, you know, a little ridiculous, and you don't even have to look back in history, but look at today, to see the massive divisions that exist on racial, ethnic, and cultural lines within the Jewish community. That, you know, there is not this one kind of Jew, is, you know, which is often put forward by the Zionist state, but rather, you know, there's what is often referred to in the Jewish community as like three distinct different ethnic and cultural groups of Jewish people. So there's Mizrahim, Jews that are from kind of around North Africa, the Middle East, parts of the Caucasus, the Sephardim from around Spain, Iberia, and Ashkenazi, the predominantly Eastern European Jews. And you think about the common language, the personal history and the religious practices of the Mizrahim are quite vastly different from that of, you know, Eastern European Jews like me. I think it's really reflected in the state of Israel, where the Ashkenazi establishment saw the newcomers, saw when the Mizrahim began to emigrate, as what they referred to as backwards Orientals, whose tradition and culture was similar to that of Israel's enemies, the Arabs. And so the Mizrahim were victims of systematic discrimination. They were locked in refugee camps. When they were let out of refugee camps, they were put into, you know, the poorest, most downtrodden neighbourhoods, many of which they still live in today. And today the Mizrahim remain significantly poorer than the Ashkenazim in Israel. Most of them still live in the same development projects they lived in the 1950s and 60s, and they're more likely to work in menial jobs and have the... There's some statistics that have come out that say that 40% of Mizrahim in Israel live just above or just below the poverty line. And I think for me, what really brings it up to me is at my school, which is a Jewish school, Zionist school, one of my Israeli friends was, you know, teaching me slang Hebrew words. And he was teaching me a word that they used to call a Mizrahim, where, you know, when he went to school in Israel, I was like, oh, well, what's the kind of translation for that word? And the best translation he could come up with is like the N-word. This is the best translation for the word that's the common slang for, you know, to refer to Mizrahim Jews. And it's just, I think, so self-evident that actually the Jews as a mass have no shared collective history. This is the reason why after the creation of the State of Israel, there was mass immigration of Eastern European Jews who were fleeing from the Holocaust, but no such mass immigration of the Mizrahim. But I think one of the other kind of questions that the Zionist state, the history of the Zionist state puts forward, throws up, is a history of the question of the survival of the Jewish people. Because the Zionist history is not just a history of exile, but also of oppression, of discrimination, and the argument that kind of Jews survived in spite of history, as opposed to saying that, you know, there was something about the Jews that meant they survived because of history. And I think there's another book that I'd really suggest people read. I'm giving you a book list when you go home. I had to read them all. And it's an argument put forward by Abraham Liaum, who talked about the Jews as what he called a people class. That under feudalism, that Jewish people were able to maintain their Jewishness and survive the Middle Ages with their religious belief intact because they performed a particular social function, which is not particularly uncommon, like a whole sections of different people in feudalism, you know, based on their ethnic background or, you know, their religious beliefs, were more likely to fit into a certain class and perform a particular social function. So, you know, Leon's analysis anticipated really, you know, because it was written before the Holocaust. He actually died in concentration camps. And it really anticipated the findings of academic Judaism by over half a century. And really, I think, really overturns the entire lacrimose view of Jewish history in Europe, which sees it only as centuries of, you know, Jewish suffering as a result of endemic anti-Semitism. You know, and Leon talks about the fact that a majority of Jews lived outside the Roman province of Judea, that the diaspora was already urbanising and characterised by commercial prosperity and beginning to be led by merchants at the time when the Second Temple had fallen, that the Jewish community was a third of the 500,000 strong population of Alexandria, which is the greatest port city of the ancient world prior to the fall of Rome, and that Jewish trading communities were sometimes so successful that they triggered conversions to Judaism in urban areas, while the Jewish peasantry slowly tended to assimilate into what was considered paganism and then increasingly into Christianity and later in some parts of the countryside into Islam. So, and while large numbers of Phoenicians and Carthaginians became Jewish, bringing them their, like, their commercial skills, Islamic expansion through the Mediterranean arena and beyond enhanced the Jewish trading role. So Jewish traders served as an important mediator in a world divided by Islam and Christianity. And again, it's, you know, that by the 9th century, Hebrew had become a leading language all throughout Europe and throughout the Middle East because this was the language of trade. This was the language, the, you know, the international language of, you know, of commerce at the time. I think, you know, without their kind of specific roles, their specific role, Jews would very likely have kind of lost their Jewishness, their specific religious beliefs. So you think about the farmers on the land, you know, slowly converting out of Judaism when they weren't actually maintaining a particular community that served a particular social role and was cohered in of itself. And, you know, the Khazai conversion, which I referred to, you know, before, well, it was the class position that Jewish people occupied and Jewish prosperity and political influence that caused this nation to convert to Judaism. Its elite actually converted to Judaism like late in the 9th century, and you know, it was about maintaining their political independence and integrating themselves into a pre-existing Jewish trade network. And a really unlikely source, I think, Abba Eben, who was a former senior Israeli cabinet minister and a classics scholar, I didn't know that was a real job, wrote in his best-selling coffee table book, Heritage, Civilization and the Jews, that Charlemagne, the, you know, quite commanding European figure of the early Middle Ages, protected the Jews because of their services to trade and finance. And he said that at this time, the original Ashkenazim Jews, or Eastern European Jews, arose as economic pioneers, men of great mercantile enterprise. They were also deeply devoted to learning. It's a nice plug for my heritage. But just very clear that this person who, you know, was very much a part of the early Zionist establishment, well, actually, you know, did not see it as a contradiction in any way, shape or form to say that actually the people of the Khazar nation, well, these were the original Jewish people. You know, at the same time, we also see that Jews were often protected by kings and local local aristocracy. But also at the same time, it's true to say that there was, you know, massive and severe Jewish persecution through some parts of Europe and at different historical junctures. And I think sometimes there, you know, some of the historians have been reading, try to write that out of history because they see it as not fitting, you know, within their particular ideological framework. But I think it's really wrong because I actually think that the, you know, the framework that sees Jews in the Middle Ages as existing as a people class, well, can actually explain this. And that actually the persecution existed not because, you know, as a lot of the Zionist historians claim, because Jews were hated because of their, you know, their Jewishness, that there was some, you know, intrinsic, you know, despising of people who held particular religious beliefs, but rather because it really served the purposes of, you know, different sections of the ruling class at different time to whip up anti-Semitism against Jewish people because of that class position they held. And I think, you know, a really good example of that is the expulsion of the Jews from England in the 1290, where they had been official bankers to the king. And it was a move by the king to, firstly, to get out of the debts he owed all the Jewish bankers, but secondly, what he then made the rest of the aristocracy do is he made the rest of the aristocracy pay their debts to him as opposed to the Jewish bankers he'd just thrown out of the country. And I think it's really significant because there's a massacre that accompanied this exile. I think it's really significant as well that the massacre, it didn't happen in Jewish people's homes. It didn't happen, you know, in their places of worship. It didn't happen in synagogues, anything like that. The massacre happened in the tower where the records were kept, where the records of who owed you what was kept. And because it was very much like people did not have a problem with Jewish people on the basis of their religious belief, but much more the problem was that they served this particular social role and that the king didn't want to be indebted to them, to have to pay back this humongous debt that he, you know, managed to rack up. One of the most spectacular examples of expulsion, though, that a lot of people talk about is from Spain and the, you know, official, you know, the Spanish Inquisition, the hunt for Jews. And I think Spain, with its discovery of the Americas, dominated the kind of the new trading market, the new world market that was starting to form. And Leon argues that Jews leaving Spain and the rest of Western Europe were absorbed into Eastern Europe, especially Poland and parts of Russia. Since some of the feudal structures survived and, you know, and it still existed there, that capitalism was still developing there. But I actually think this is where Leon's argument falls down, is where some of what Shlomo Sand says, where his far more updated archaeological evidence and all of that comes to the fore. You think about Leon writing before the Holocaust. Leon sees the expulsion from Spain as the single most important factor explaining why the majority of Jews today live in Poland, live in Russia, and other parts of Eastern Europe. But the thing about the Khazar nation, the history of the Khazar nation, I actually think far more effectively explains why it is that the majority of Jews, when you saw the beginning of the Holocaust, were already in Eastern Europe, that the territory of the Khazar nation was basically much of modern-day Russia, Western Kazakhstan, Eastern Ukraine, Armenia, large portions of the Northern Caucasus, parts of Georgia, not the one that Sarah Palin lives in, the other one, Northern Iran and Northeast Turkey. So actually, it wasn't that there was a mass wave of Jewish immigration. But actually that the majority of European Jews are descendants of people who already lived in that area. So there, it seems that there was some immigration more towards Poland, because Jewish people in Poland were given the role, were given the role by what the, Polish landlords, who were mostly absentee landlords, were given the role of collecting taxes, on behalf of the absentee landlords, so could get along in a fairly good economic position. But at the same time, we can also see that this, again, under, you know, in Poland, also gave the ruling class there another ability to use this as a way to whip up anti-Semitism against Jewish people. Again, not based on their Jewishness, but rather based on the position that they were forced into at a certain period of time. But I think it's important to say that this is not actually the way anti-Semitism functions today, and it's a bit like that's kind of a bit beyond the topics of this discussion, but that you could say all throughout feudalism that actually Jews existed in a certain class position. This was the basis of the way anti-Semitism was whipped up. Well, this is not actually true today, because all throughout the, you know, the West, where capitalism is, you know, far more developed, Jews can just be effectively absorbed into the system. Throughout the East, where there's, you know, a long history of anti-Semitism, or throughout sections of Europe, the kind of old prejudice can be re-whipped up. But it's not actually on the basis of Jews currently occupying a particular class position. Like, I think it's kind of a bit outside of the bounds of this topic, but it's important to realise that there is quite a big distinction between anti-Semitism today and anti-Semitism at this point in time and how it was manufactured. And I think to kind of end in a way that I think that while the nationalists surrounding the state of Israel are important, and to understand what's wrong with these myths, why they're incorrect, what the problems with them are, I actually don't think they are the most important thing to have a comprehension of in the understanding of why it is that actually you shouldn't support the apartheid state of Israel. And I think this is pretty evident to me when you realise the fact that actually both Shlomo Sands and Arthur Koestler, the man who wrote the book The 13th Tribe, both support the continuation of the existence of the state of Israel. That Koestler said in, you know, one of the appendices of his book, The whole claim about whether or not Zionist Jews, or Jews who live in Israel today, are related to the original inhabitants of the land, said it is irrelevant, it can't affect Israel's right to exist. That Shlomo Sands said, well, actually what it is that the Israeli state needs to, you know, to accept the painful process, is what he calls it, and can today claim the right to exist only by accepting a painful historical process that led to its creation. But actually, I think the point we have to say is, well, I actually don't think it would matter if the Romans had expelled masses of Jewish people who had then been scattered to the winds all throughout Eastern Europe. I don't think it would have mattered if there had been, you know, if this had been the legitimate history of the Jewish people, and of Jewish history suffered, you know, massive anti-Semitism under feudalism, under capitalism as well. Well, I actually don't think that justifies the genocide and dispossession of the Palestinian people. So I think that it's something that people have to have a bit of a balance of. While it's important to be able to say, well, actually, we can totally debunk the kind of founding nationalist myths of the state of Israel, well, the far more important thing, I think, is actually saying, well, we don't support the genocide, ongoing genocide and dispossession of a group of people, irregardless of the political history that may have affected Jewish people historically under feudalism.